Hey, can you explain this one to me, in passing? I'm watching a television show the other night, inadvertently, primarily because a friend of mine was on it, and if I didn't watch it, there'd be trouble. And so I'm watching this television show, and the announcer says, "And now, direct from Hollywood, in living color, on tape, we bring you..." Well, you know, I went back into deep center field there, and I tried to snag that one, but I was in the vines before I knew what happened, and it was a good sound triple. I mean, off the, you know, field here. Live on tape. I can you decipher that? Now, I'm sure that what is developing is a special TV language that the people who watch television, who are part of that esoteric world, that cross-reference world, you know, they'll compare in their mind Paladin versus Maverick. They know every, you know, they know who Chester is and all this, the whole scene. That the history of television, which of course is the history of the modern world in their mind, must have started about 1955, apparently, roughly about the time the big series shows started. I wonder if an old timer sits around occasionally and reminisces about early episodes in Wagon Train. When, you know, says, "Ah, it wasn't always this way. I never forget one time." do they really? I guess they do. And so, of course, this is all part of the vicarious life. And naturally, because it is now a religion, there's no question about not. It's not really a religion. I shouldn't use such words so quickly. It's not a religion at all. It's a culture. The TV viewer is part of a culture. Now, it's not part of the American culture. Don't immediately let them, "Hey, rotten American culture, decadent rotten values." No. The television viewer is the same the world over. I don't know whether you've ever seen an Italian TV viewer. Same scene. I was in Rome, and you could see that there were two separate societies growing. One was the TV world there, and the other was, you know, the walkers around her. Because there is a mystique about the true television viewer that is completely dedicated. Now, I know people, it has been reported to me by spies I have in various offices and one thing and another, that the only source of genuine conversation in many offices today, you know, around the secretary pool and back in the file department and so on, the only source of free-flowing, moving conversation is about various television shows. Is this true? That it is? The people in the various shows have assumed a kind of reality to these people that no other form of communication or entertainment has ever even remotely approached. And so I'm sure that this new thing, it's developing its own language. Have you noticed in the, if you read TV Guide, you know what it, now the language appears to be the same one we're talking, you and I here, but it's very different in actual meaning. For example, what does living tape mean? Well, a television viewer would know. Live and in color on tape, which is the opening of a show that I heard the other day, previously recorded. That's the way they say it. Live, it's coming to you live from Hollywood and in full living color, previously recorded. We bring you... You know, I guess it is possible to be live and taped simultaneously in the TV world. Of course, George Orwell... pointed this out, that eventually the language would reverse itself, and I'm sure that today most people accept tape as life, and I'm constantly running into this all the time. People look at me with great disbelief when they say, "Do you do your show live?" And I say, "Yes, I'm there. I do the show live." "Oh, come on. Now, why don't you level with me? This happens to me a dozen times a day." And I say, no, I really do. I go down and do it. I say, what do you mean? You really do it live? And somehow it's as though I am cheating now. That doing it live, somehow there is an onus of some sort of underhandedness about a live show. You see? So I have to kind of apologize for it. I say, "Well, you know, the station likes to save tape. They save it for the important shows, Faye Hanley and that. And they like to save tape, and the engineers get mad when they have to record. So I have to come in. It's just us poor, the peasant-type performers that have to come in and do it live." "Oh, I see. And so we had a call. I think one of the greatest calls of a long time was a guy that called one night, and... he said, "I want to know the name of the record that's playing." And the girl on the phone says, well, that's not a record. That is Mr. Shepard. He's... Yeah, well, I know it's... I hear the name is Shepard. I hear that. I know that. But I want to know the name of the record. I want to buy the record. And she says, well, he's not a record, you know. He's there doing it. Well, I know he's saying the funny stuff, but where can I buy the record? She said, but he's not a record. He is not a record. Look, what's your name, miss? And she says, well, my name is Miss Brown. Oh, all right. I'll get you fired right out of that place. Now, give me the wise stuff. Now, what's the name of the record? She says, but he's live. I know he's recorded live. Now, I want to know the name of the LP. Now, I got all the good LPs. I got Shirley Berman. I got Manny Schwartz. I got Max Factor at the Blue Note. I got Morty Saul, and I got Lenny Bruce. I want to get this guy's record. He must be very good. I want the record. And she, but he's not on record. Oh, don't you come back with me to wise stuff. Now, what's your name? Brown. All right, I'll get you fired. All right, give me the name of the guy's record. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, 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 oh. For the benefit of those of you who have just tuned in, this is a recording of our program department in deep session. They are invoking the spirit of evil itself. They are calling upon the devil to come down from wherever the devil hangs out to make a good offer. They're willing to sell out the whole program department. Anything for a rating is what he has just said. I'm translating from the Igorodi. He is now saying, remember, men, we are in business. Dough is what we're in business for. Remember it. He is now saying certain long hair, egg-headed soreheads, prominent vomiters, are constantly degrading radio. Well, we know what it's about, and they're going to find out what it's about. We're practical men. Hello. Oh, there they go. They all gone down to Dunhall's now for a drink. Seal the pact. Seal the bargain. No, that's enough. That's enough. You know, speaking of Mad Ev, one of the wildest, most recent developments. Have you heard Homer and Jethro? How about Confucius say? You know, Confucius say, "Hey Homer," and it's, "Oh, that's corny." Well, I used to work with old Homer and Jethro, and I wonder if Madison Avenue knows who Confucius is or was. I mean, really, do they know the reverence that he has held in large sections of the earth? Seriously? Well, don't you know? Confucius was not a comic book character, you know. All right, okay, you know that. All right, and I wonder now what would happen if Radio Beiping or if some big cereal company in Shanghai decides to have a contest, Christ Says contest on the back of their thing, and they have singing commercials to try to sell, you know. I mean, oh boy, look at everybody getting mad at me right away. But I'm just proposing a little modest proposal here, that's all. Fast and loose. I'm sure that eventually there will be, as one of my listeners points out, there will be a Kennedy joke book, and it will be used to sell something. Eventually, but this Confucius say thing is very intriguing to me. And it's very funny the way they do it. But you know, there was a man named Confucius, and he was an important man, and his teachings are important to many people. And I'm just curious what kind of propaganda it would make to come around. You know, here I have the back of the. What is this? Yes, it's cornflakes. Kellogg's cornflakes. Homer and Jethro's Confucius say joke book. This a little passing thing there. It could cause a little. Of course, this is the very thing that we always claim that we're against, and that is taking a race or taking a nationality and making a joke out of it. You know, they're playing even on the Chinese. If you notice the way they play on the Chinese accent, You know, clown ferocious say. This is a whole big thing. Now, I'm sure nobody would think of doing that with, let's say, Negroes today. They just wouldn't do it. No one would even think, a few years ago on radio, they used to always do it with Yiddish comics, one thing or another. But somehow, it's okay to do it with the Chinese. You know, just a modest proposal. Speaking of modesty, this is friendly old WOR, AM and FM, New York, and we'll be here for a while. And that's a funny commercial, but it has some, you know, just little side issues there that that could be brought. You know, speaking of side issues, a great little note came through. And we might as well, while we're on the subject of that, I've been getting a lot of letters about it, and people seem to be running across the Saturday show by accident. I'm getting to have a really jaundiced eye about what people call promotion. You know, almost everybody in this country believes that promotion will do anything. They do. I had a person call me from Newsweek magazine. They said, we want a quote on the Beatles. How about all that promotion? You know, promotion must have done it. And I said, no, what are you talking about? You mean to tell me you really are that naive that you think promotion can create a giant movement of that? Oh, yeah, good promotion. That would make it becoming a star or becoming anything the easiest thing in the world. You go out and get yourself a good promoter, and that's it. You're a big deal. No. I've found that promoters often pay credit for it, and promoters often hook on at the very end. It's like the guy at the 500 race, you know, at Indianapolis, latching onto a car at mile 499 and picking that one as the winner. And, because most of the things I've been around, I like the Beatles and so on, I've seen these things grow. Most of the things that happen grow out of a genuine situation in a society. Boom! It explodes, and nobody wants to concede, you see, that this could actually happen without being engineered. We have such a great faith in engineering things that we believe everything's engineered. Wars are started, doesn't matter. Pestilences come out, engineer that did it, obviously. And so the belief in America, of course, is stronger in engineering events than anywhere else in the world. Everywhere else in the world, they're a little bit more realistic about history. And so almost every American politician he'll come out with, who sold out China? Who sold? The point being that everybody thinks, you know, somehow we could have prevented everything that happened in China. If the right engineer had been at the throttle, it would not have happened. So we allow stuff in Cuba. Come here. As though somebody created Cuba. Or didn't create Cuba or something. In short, what I'm saying is that we do believe that anything that happens can be created, just totally, just out of whole cloth. You just cut it out, and there it is. You got China. You cut it out, or you sold out to Russia, or you cut it out, or you sold out at Yalta. You did any one of a million things. You see, it's the belief that all history and all events are contrived by sinister men, or are not contrived by good men. In short, nothing just happens. It can't possibly be that way. And so they called me and they said, "What about the Beatles?" And I said, "What do you mean, what about the Beatles?" I said, "Well, you know, great promotion, wasn't it? I mean, terrific." I said, "No, not a bit of it. Not a bit of it. No promoter could take four guys out of a town in England and make them a worldwide phenomenon. If he is, I mean, if he could, you know, forget it." Of course, this makes it safer then, you see. It makes it safer for us to believe that everything is the result of a machination. It's like everyone believes, well, you know, Hitler was created. They just created it. Oh, no. I'm sorry. It's a little more complicated than that. And so in the end, you know, you wonder where the creation stopped. I remember one time, do you remember the I Libertine thing and all that I was involved in? There was no promotion, no press, no, nothing like that involved. And to this very day, the myth persists. you know, it was all a big scheme, a big promotion, big deal. And, Leader would be surprised if he heard that, Mr. L here at the station. but this is always something that I've wondered about, is that naive belief that Sinatra was created by screaming teenagers that were hired by a guy. Just simple like that. That's all. Just so simple, no problem. Just get somebody to scream and you're in business. Or, people really believe that. If you want to be a movie star, you go out and get yourself a press agent. Put your name in the paper about 50 times, and the next thing you know, you're in a Universal picture. No problem. No problem at all. Nothing to it. This belief is constantly implicit in everything. If you want to sell people something, you just buy enough ads. They'll buy it. Oh, yeah? A lot of guys have lost their you-know-what betting on that one. Doesn't work that way. For example, WOR must have spent like $200,000 advertising the fact that I have a show on Saturday from 10 until midnight. Nobody knows it. He said, "Oh, this rat told me across the dial. And all of a sudden I heard you and I couldn't believe my ears there. What is it? Somebody playing a record of you? What?" I get these letters all the time. Well, for the benefit of those of you who don't know, I'm on every Saturday night from 10 until midnight. And it comes direct from a swinging place called the Limelight down in the Village. It's live. It's not on tape. That's another thing they keep saying. Well, you must tape that earlier, you know. Somehow no one can conceive of a guy getting out in front of an audience and doing something. It's inconceivable today. It is. You know, that one of the surprised looks I saw on the face of somebody, Fred, was one time I was on the Steve Allen Show. And a lot of people had come from places like Idaho and Iowa and Indiana and everything else. They had the tickets, you see. And they all lined up, and they brought him in. And all of a sudden, a real live Steve Allen is out on the stage. And they had a funny look on their face as though, you know, it was like seeing the Tin Woodman, as though the Tin Woodman was live, you know, walking around. Raggedy Ann came to visit him. It was, you know, they were stunned. They sit there in the audience, sort of stunned. There's Steve Allen on the face. And he's he plays the piano. And they've been watching him for 2 years, you know. Somehow he's a TV screen picture. He's not a real person. And you know, they all sit there and they look at each other sort of funny, and Allen's up there. And that's why they have audience warm-ups. It takes an audience a half an hour to come out of its stunned, its stupor, you know. It's just, well, you mean there's a real, look at that guy, he looks just like Ed Sullivan. And so, well, he is. Oh, come on, Earl, look at him. Yeah. And then the camera picks him up. They clap and say, "Hey, you're a real audience. You're a real audience. Hey, oh," and they keep looking. "Look, there's Josh." Oh, yeah. And they can't believe it. They're stunned for at least a half an hour. So they have to bring people in there to in a sense, cold turkey them from audience, from TV viewing. You know, they have to sort of. It's like it's like cracking them of a habit or something. And I'm sure that, you know what the most intriguing aspect of all this unreality quality is? Here I am sitting up there, and I've done like 50 different TV shows of that kind. I was on the Kovac show and the Parr show and so here they all are out there. And the first thing that gets you is the show goes on the air, you see, and it's going, and Skitch Henderson turns around and wiggles his beard, you know, and then whoever the fat-headed announcer is, he comes in and says, "Oh, no, here he is, the star of our show, Jack Parr," and Jack Parr comes out through the audience, you know, he comes up to the curtains, and they're and where do you think they're looking? At the monitor screen. They're all over there, and he's come out on the monitor screen. You know, they keep and for the first half hour of the show, nobody's looking at the stage. That's up there live. They're all sitting there. There's a 21-inch monitor, and they're all with their mouth hanging open. You know, because that's real to them. It really is real. It's at the you know, and they look like this. Oh, Josh, when you hear those audiences applauding for people, who do you think they're applauding? They're applauding the screen. They really are, seriously. And for a good half hour, and you sit up on the stage and watch it. It's very spooky. And it is. I'm telling you an absolute truth. I'm not inventing this. You will see, say, Parr will be sitting there talking to God or somebody. You know, he's sitting there, and Parr is, the way I look at it, Fred, and Parr is bouncing around in the seat, and you see the guy sitting next to him, and Zsa Zsa's over here, and Hermione Gingold's waiting to cackle, and, you know, the whole scene is that. And you look out between the curtains, and you wonder what they're looking at. You think they're looking at an accident off to the left there. The entire audience is looking off to the left, to a man, you see. They're all looking. And you wonder, what the devil are they looking at? You know, what's over there? And you keep trying to peek around, because right in front of you, the show is going on, you know. And Parr says, "Oh, come on. Oh, no, come on. What do you mean? Yeah. Well, look what Jack Gould said about me. He's telling me, look at Jack. That's such a nice guy. Ah!" He's crying. And they're all there, and you can see the tears coming into their eyes. The audience are looking out there, you know, they're crying for Jack or whatever it is they're crying for. And the tears are coming to their eyes, but they're still looking left. And you, well, what, devil's going on? And backs, of course, the stagehands are very used to it now. You know, they just and that's why they put that screen for them. They put that screen there because they found out that the first half hour of any live television show, people are thoroughly confused. They don't even know there's an act going on. You know, because they're so unused to seeing real things. They don't know. You know, they're a little embarrassed. You know, here's Skitch standing there. Well, you know, you can't laugh at a man. You know, he's standing there. He wiggles his beard. And you don't laugh at a man out loud wiggling his beard. You know, just you're used to that in your living room. You sort of pretend that he's not there. But you do laugh at the screen. So they look at the screen. It's old Steve over there. Look at old Steve there. And they found out they have to put a monitor screen for people in a television studio because they get very nervous if they don't. Yes, it's quite true. The unreality is becoming it's so I go down to the limelight. This is part of that. I go down to the limelight, and people all sit for at least a half an hour, and with a funny look on their face, a real funny look. First of all, they don't think I have feet. When you are on the radio or on television, somehow you have a total image or a non-image. Maybe it's a total thing that a guy has in his own mind, and so nobody ever thinks of the fact that, say, Steve Allen wears brown suits, you know, or the fact that Steve Allen sweats. You don't see that on the screen, I think, or you know that the when the tap dancer comes out and he finishes singing or dancing, whatever, he goes. You don't see that, you know, on the screen. Somehow the camera is now back over at the band, or it's over at Edie Gourmet or somebody like. And he's very confused at real life people. Very confused. Oh, it's a real confusion. He prefers it in the screen, really, because the screen somehow is safe and it's part and it's home, and he thinks of his refrigerator and all that stuff and the beer he's drinking. But when he's confronted with the real thing, there is genuine confusion. I think that the first politician who uses this principle, and there hasn't been one yet, there has not been one yet who has really done it, is going to make the scene boy all the way. Just don't do any personal appearances. I think what killed Barry Goldwater is making PAs. Really. That when you can be on a very carefully controlled set, where the lighting is right, you can be dynamic, you know. And I say, we ought to go and blow them up! And everybody cheers. Well, you know, when suddenly you appear in person, and you saw little and the sun comes down, and the wind is blowing through your ears, and you're standing in front of the A&P, it just doesn't seem the same. It really doesn't. Have you noticed today that more people are voting for a candidate that isn't on the scene? That's right. It's more than a coincidence there. The candidates, I predict, the candidates are going to learn a lesson from this. And it's not that they are, you know, they're voting for a guy that's not arguing the issues, as poor old Rockefeller keeps saying. I think they're voting for an image. I think they're voting for a non-existent thing, which is much safer and more friendly somehow than the vote for a real-life person. Because real-life persons are fallible. You know, they sort of stand around, and somebody in the crowd hollers, "All right, Barry, what about Cuba? What would you do about Cuba, wise guy?" And the next thing you know, Barry's, "Well, wait, I have a paper here, and the wind is what? Forget it, he's dead. Forget it. I mean, forget it." And any good performer knows, keep that gulf between you and the audience. Because can you imagine what would happen if after, let's say, they're doing Hamlet, you know, and Olivier finishes, and so the crowd cheers, and then Olivier comes out on the apron, you know, after they put the lights up, and there he is, he's sweating. You know, he's sweating. Somebody says, "Hey, Larry, what about that bit in the second act there when you got the sword? How come you got it caught in your cape, you bum?" Well, the next thing you know, forget it. He's the world's worst actor. Because the minute you open yourself up to the audience, you're dead. Because the audience wants an abstraction. Our greatest presidents are always the dead ones. Have you noticed that? Oh, sure, and there's a reason for that, always. Again, it's an abstraction. They become an abstraction almost automatically, immediately. The minute you allow yourself to be yelled at and hollered at by the rabble, forget it. You're just like the guy down at the pool room. You know? Oh, yeah. Every 12-year-old kid loves to go home and say, boy, did I tell Shepard off? Oh, boy. You know? And he loves this feeling. And in that sense, he has scored a victory. Not really, but he has proved that you are human, and that is in itself a great victory for the vast audience. I watched, now many a good performer, of course, will not allow that. He does his performance, and he does not make himself available to the public. Now, they may say, oh, what a rotten guy, he didn't come out. But they come back. The guy that comes out and argues and yells with them is, oh, he ain't so great. What are you talking about, Harry? I'll tell you, the other night, I'm sitting there and I said to him, say, look, Aaron, I got a funnier joke than you. You've been telling jokes for years on the show. I got a funnier one than ever. Let me tell you, what's purple and swims? How about that one? Well, then I said to him, what's green and swims? Well, he says, I don't know. And I says, oh, Moby Pickle. How do you like that? And I'll tell you, cut him down dead. Nothing to it. The audience laughed. Oh, that guy's a bum. Well, so you know in the end, of course, that the performer, and the further away a performer is from his audience, the greater he will be considered by the audience, believe it or not. Generally, the audience likes to think that the guy that mingles with them will be called a great one. But that's not true. J.D. Salinger is a prime example of it in the writing world. If Salinger left the cabin or whatever it is he's got in Vermont and came down and started to make the panel circuit, if he was on there every afternoon with Johnny or Jackie or Maggie McNellis or Arlene Francis or all, you know, the Whoopi crew, he would be dead in a minute. The mystique would go in 5 minutes. And so he stays out of it. And a lot of people say, oh, well, yeah, but it's because he's such a fantastic artist. Well, maybe. But I can tell you he would soon cease to be if he started to argue it out with Jack Parr, or if he started to argue it out with Johnny Carson, or whatever his name is, you know, old oatmeal, you know. And so you wind up knowing that the guy... And now, one of the reasons why TV performers and radio are not considered... on a par, you see, with the great performers of the theater, is that they are too accessible. You can turn them on in your own house. You turn a guy on in your own house, he's not going to be great. You turn that TV set on in your own house, he's not great. I mean, look at I can turn him off. You just reach him, turn him off. See, I'm not great. Subtle. It's very subtle. You turn a guy on and off. But when you march down to the Brooks Atkinson, you lay down your $9.90 per single seat, you sit down, you ain't going to turn Laurence Olivier off in the middle of the second act. If anybody's going to be turned off, it's you. You just, you know, so you're sitting there and you get this sense of godlike, a godlike thing is occurring. A godlike thing is happening. And it's almost like something that is beyond your control, totally beyond your control. And so the merest spear carrier in a Broadway show is considered a great artist. He'll be interviewed, he'll be discussed. You hear some of the world's worst performers, sad actors, just terrible, will be interviewed on various shows that interview, and the poor interviewer sits there with just adulation dripping, merely because that guy's on a stage. That's scary enough for most people. He can get on the stage and just stand there with his tennis shoes falling off, but he's up there. And that gives him a sense. He's up there, and And what was your first play?
Well, my first actual professional appearance came in Canton, Ohio. I was put on the bill there with Alfred Lunt and Lynn Fontaine. Wonderful people. I actually don't see Al very much. Of course, the poor guy. You know what he did was sell orange juice. There and now what is he doing now? You know, he comes in the middle of the second act of this play, which is really on its uppers. It's written by a poor, sad ex-playwright who's still grinding them out of nervous energy, and he comes in the second act and he plays the father, you know, of the nervous, beautiful, sweet Sandy Dennis type teenager, you know, and all he does is say, but my dear, don't you think that young man is a little fast for you? And they say, what a life. And then about 5 minutes later, he's back in his dressing room, and he's a big thing for the night. And now he's told to go out by the PA, the press agent, to go around and plug the show.
That's his job. He's plugging the show. And so this poor, sad actor, who is a bad actor from the word go, but nevertheless is given a great deal of honest adulation and honest admiration merely because he is there. Very, very intriguing, this remoteness from that people have about the things that they observe. Now, I saw a performer one night. It's a funny little thing. I saw a performer who, very fine humorist who really performs well, one of the few that I think was good in recent years, who really genuinely had a humorous, was funny. He was a funny man. And he finished a show, and it was a TV show, very fine. He finished the show, and he made the great mistake of walking out through the audience, and of course immediately everybody's talking to him, and he gets out in front of the theater, which was over in the 40s somewhere, in the West 40s, the TV theater at the time. And 5 minutes later, there's about 25 kids and guys standing around him on the sidewalk saying, "Well, look, you know, why don't you do what I am? And they're arguing. A couple of guys are saying, like, well, within 5 minutes, I saw this guy go from a fine performer to a, you might say, a haggler. He was haggling, you know. And he would argue with people over a bit and so on. And, you know, I said, oh, wow. And sure enough, it finally began to get him, that eventually the audience never accepted him as a fine performer because he made himself open to be argued with. He would argue with people, and he would allow them to control him, which is the last thing that an audience wants. Even though it secretly thinks that it does want it, it's the last thing that an audience wants. And this is one of the reasons why movies are becoming bigger than any other form of communication today, is because they are completely impersonal. You know, that 47-foot-high image of Peter Sellers makes it seem to everybody that he's the greatest thing, believe me, since St. Peter. And so there he is up there, and you can't argue, he doesn't sweat, you can't argue with him, he's edited. And he is totally unreachable. Everybody in the movies is unreachable because they're not there. It's a machine that plays them. And once you get played through a machine, believe me, you've really made it. One of the secret lures of the charger plate system is somehow when they're putting your plate through the machine, it's as though that machine is making it real. It's official. You really feel as though this inhuman thing has recognized you. And in reverse, of course, we all know that the movies are a machine. They're definitely a machine. It's an optical illusion, little shadows moving back and forth on the screen there, and you can almost do anything you want with it. You use echo chambers, and you can make guys with little mousy voices sound like they got great voices. You can make little guys look like big guys. It's always a scary thing for most people to realize the actual size of Charlton Heston. It's surprising. The actual physical size of Marlon Brando. Yeah. You'd be surprised, ladies. Almost all of the guys you know, the little shrimpy husbands you know, are taller than Brando. and so we don't want this, you know. We want this great superhuman image. Everyone likes to believe that the girls on the screens, for example, are just absolutely prettier than any other girl that's ever been. The minute you're on a screen, you're a beautiful girl automatically. Even if you're not a beautiful, you're beautiful. You're just beautiful. You're radiant. And you wind up with this image of the machine created the untouchable thing. So if you're sitting in an audience in a live production, and out comes this little guy, and he says he's Moses. Well, you know, you're kind of bugged. You say, well, now, wait a minute, you know, and he sort of shuffles across the stage. You hear the board squeaking. You hear the scenery going a little bit. Well, you just don't... Have you noticed that most modern playwrights today do not deal with the big themes? Well, believe me, Moses does not appear often on the stage. He appears quite often in movies. Biblical epics are constantly appearing in movies because you can amplify the people like 1,000%. You know, you can photograph them from their kneecaps up, and they all look like they're the Time Life building walking around. And you wouldn't dare do that on the stage. Believe me, you just couldn't, because on the stage there are real life people up there, and the audience distrusts real life people. Now, there is a far away enough distance, you see, from them for you to have a kind of godlike feeling about them. But believe me, an actor is not really officially a god in this country. In fact, most places in the world, until he's on the screen, then he achieves true god status. True god status. People are always a little disappointed to find that Cary Grant had a stage background. Yeah, they're disappointed. They're always disappointed to find that Clark Gable did a lot of stage work before he became Clark Gable on the screen. Somehow that doesn't seem, you know, you kind of hate the idea of somehow, you know. It's a very subtle little thing. And yet at the same time, and so they play that down. You'll find that very few movie people who are really, you know, the really great stars, rarely talk about their stage thing. Rarely. That's very suspect to the movie hangers, the real hang-up people. They want to think that the movie people just sort of sprang like Topsy out of the soil of human virtue, like giant gods. You know, they don't have any of these things like agents and stuff. Well, I don't know how I got on this subject, but it's an interesting subject, and it isn't talked about much from the standpoint of the performer. But I will say this. That from the standpoint of the performer, quite often people resent the fact, because they know him or her, they resent the fact that he doesn't know them. Oh yeah, a person who for 28 years has watched nothing but Audrey Hepburn movies is always a little miffed when he bangs on the door someday, he finally gets to where she is. And you know, she's in a play, and he gets backstage, and he bangs on the door, and the girl comes out. The dresser says, "Well, Miss Hepburn can't see anyone after the show." And he said, "But what do you mean? My name is Charles Witherspoon, and I have never missed an Audrey Hepburn picture for the last 19 years. And I'm an old friend. You know, somewhat. Your next word is, I'm an old friend. You know, I've been in love with her for years. What do you mean?" And he gets very mad when she will not see him. Somehow the people have a crazy subtle thing that it is a two-way situation. I'm sure that many a kid who is a real nut on Salinger would you know, J.D. Salinger would love to get his bicycle and ride all the way up to where it is in the woods and go trekking finally through the weeds and finally arrive in front of Salinger cabin there and pound on the door. "It's me, it's Clarence, I want to talk to you, hey J.D., hey Holden." And then the next thing you know, a door opens and a great big manservant grabs this kid by the scruff of the neck and tosses him out on US 8, you know, on all fours. And he would then say, "Oh, what a phony he is, what a phony he is." Why is he a phony? He didn't put in the back of his book, "Any of you kids that want to come up to my place, come on up and visit me." Not once. Audrey does not look down out of the screen and say, "Oh yes, by the way, I'm very cute here today in this movie with Rock. And for all of you guys who, why don't you come and visit me backstage when you come in?" No, never. But it is applied somehow. And if she doesn't see them, they're phonies. They're terrible phony people. And yet, I wonder how many of you open your doors to strangers. When you're, you know, right after you're, I wonder how many people you allow come in to see you just like that. "Well, what do you mean? I'm always buying the books that your company sells. I like your books. You ought to come in. I want to come in and have a drink with you." And you say, "Well, no. I'm sorry about you. You phony, you phony." And yet, there it is. It's an odd thing. Well, I'll tell you, we had a little scene the other day. I suppose I shouldn't even talk about these things on the air, but. They're constantly coming up where people cannot understand the fact that a performer is a performer, and what he does, he's performing. You know, he really works awfully hard at it. It's a sweat, hard, struggling thing. You wring it out of a. It's like honest to John. It's like taking a hold of a some nights. It's some days, some weeks, some years. It's like taking a hull of a turnip and wringing it, you know, and trying to fill up a quart jug, you know. And you work, you know, and they somehow think it's all fun in Playsville. And not only that, if you don't come around and say it is, that shows you're phony. And furthermore, if you don't spend 4 hours with them drinking, that shows you're rotten. It really shows you're rotten. And I think one of the most intriguing aspects of this is to find that almost inevitably, when a performer does consent to have a drink with somebody, the guy never talks to the performer and asks him about things, you know, the things that about his work, what he does. You know what he does? He says, you know, I'll tell you, Steve, a very funny thing, I'll tell you a joke. One time there was a guy, but I, you know, I was talking about, how about another drink? Hey, Steve, I don't know. And this goes on for about 2.5 hours, and finally Steve says, well, excuse me, but I've got 8 people waiting for me. What do you mean? I'm just getting started here. And sure enough, they hardly ever talk to the performer. They come and tell the performer something about themselves. They come and they grab you by the arm and they say, hey, you know, hey, Shep, you know, the other day I'm sitting there and I saw this guy and I said, hey, Matt, Mabel, what about, and you know, you want to say, well, you know, fella, yeah, I appreciate it, but... What am I going to do? You know what? And it goes, and you wonder whether or not what this subtle thing is, the relationship. I imagine there are a lot of doctorates eventually going to be written on this, because this is the first, I suspect, the first generation, and in fact the first country that has become a total audience, a complete audience, that their entire attitude towards things is as an audience, literally as an even on world events. Why do you think most of our comics make all of their comic bits about real world events? That seems more real to them than to read the New York Times about the real thing. They're a total audience, and somehow Lenny Bruce talking about Cuba is far realer than a Castro speech. Far of a speech by Castro himself. You know, they don't read this. The total world of an audience is complete. And this presents some pretty fascinating sociological problems. It really does. And it presents not only problems, but there are insoluble ones. And then, of course, I suppose the terrible urge that a lot of people feel, that if they could sit down with Castro, they could talk to him. You know, Castro would be interested in what they have to say. Because Castro, too, is a performer to most people. And so even the great stage of events out there begin to take on the same classicism of a Western. Good guys and bad guys, separate. Good guys, sympathetic guys, unsympathetic guys. It's all part of some kind of a tremendous film, so many people. And the shock of seeing a real Khrushchev scared many a guy on 34th Street. Just, you know, a real one. Just sitting there looking out, waving, and sweating, eating cheese.